Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Depression and bipolar illness impact one in five Americans. They cost our economy billions of dollars a year in lost productivity, and yet more is spent treating them than treating cancer. Yet half of the sufferers do not receive the care they need. My guest today is Dr. John Greeden. He's founding chair and president of the National Network of Depression Centers. He's also executive director and founder of the University of Michigan Depression Center and a former chair of psychiatry at the University of Michigan. Dr. Greeden, it's a pleasure to have you join us on Line One.
Dr. Woodard, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Let's jump right in and get some definitions and tell us about how we might understand what we mean by depression and anxiety and bipolar illness.
Happily. So clinical depression, and I'm going to make a point right away. We're probably talking clinical depressions, plural, because they don't all come from the same cause. And we're talking bipolar illnesses, plural again. But they are syndromes that stem from things that aren't going right in our brains. And they're linked to stresses. They're linked to events. They're linked to substances that we use, alcohol, drugs. They're also very much genetic in the way of having a predisposition, but not totally driven by that. So simply having another member of a family who's had depressions doesn't mean I'm going to get it. But that combination, I think, confuses people. And how we understand them is more along the lines of their symptoms. So clinical depressions are characterized by loss of pleasure, sadness, sleep disturbances, change in appetite, sometimes actually eating too much. And change in voice, people get flat and they don't talk the same, they don't have energy, sleep disturbances are very characteristic, and in many circumstances, thoughts and even sometimes, sadly, acts of, I don't want to go on living anymore, suicide attempts. And when we put all of those together, that's something that I think most people recognize pretty well. That's the depression part. Anxiety, which goes along with these things rather commonly, is the worrying, the stress, the fear, oh my gosh, I'm not going to get this right. Sometimes it's got a lot of physical features associated with it, tremulousness, racing heartbeat, and it is this sense of something terrible is going to happen. The bipolar pattern, which is often seen as the converse or inverse or opposite, not necessarily is, but it's often seen that way for depression, is when people have cycles, and some of those cycles are, I've got too much energy, speaking too rapidly, having ideas that are coming too fast, sometimes too grandiose. I'm going to save the world. I'm going to solve all of the illnesses. And when that gets to be an extreme, that's a term that we commonly use, someone is manic. And in milder forms, it's actually referred to in a term that's not very good, but it's hypomanic, a little less than mania. And we can elaborate on those a little bit more if we get through. But those three syndromes have been around for, 100 years when they're pretty well understood, and they've had different names, but depressions, bipolar illnesses, and anxiety disorders all are things that are pretty distressing to those in society, and your figure of one in five is very correct.
Let me remind our listeners once again, this is Line One, your health connection. My guest is Dr. John Greeden. He's a past chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan. If you've got questions or comments about any of the illnesses and problems we're discussing today, which include bipolar illness, anxiety, and depression, this is a great time to call and ask your question or email us. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And you need to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, as one word, at alaskapublic.org. Dr. Greeden, when I think of depression, I can think of getting sad or overwhelmed or feeling out of control at times with so much to do. And then I can think of major depression, where nothing seems to bring people back from this feeling of unbelievable despair. So there must be more to it than just being a little sad at times, and different maybe types or varieties of depression.
Absolutely there is, and I think it's an important concept for your listeners to struggle with and grasp, because, well, if you'll let me just be a little bit trite, so I'm at the University of Michigan, and I like football, and when we lose a key bowl game, I'm depressed, but I'm not clinically depressed, and I think that differentiation is really vital to make, because what occurs is the fact that the illness part, the sickness, if you will, comes in degrees that can sometimes be mild, and in fact, that's how they generally start. But unchecked and untreated, they become very severe. And I think that the differentiation, when we get to what is called major depressive disorder in our terminologies and our official diagnostic nomenclatures, and minor, or what some call dysthymia, just a lesser version, is fairly profound. And those illnesses are quite different than the feeling of sadness and disappointment when you lose a football game, for example, or when something just doesn't happen the way you want at home. And so I'm glad you brought it up right away, because what I think we mean when we talk clinical depressions is more often the severe kind. And these are just devastating illnesses, and they need to be recognized as such.
And I'm going to throw out this term that physicians use, pathophysiology, is the development, is what we know about the underlying changes in the brains different than in each of these clinical depressions and the feeling depressed if our team has lost a bowl game? Are these different, or is it, one, an exaggeration of what's already there with the milder forms of being unhappy about how something happened?
Yeah, I'll see if I can answer. It's a sophisticated question. Pathophysiology means those things that sort of are underlying the causes of our symptoms and illnesses, whether it's cardiac, heart, or diabetes, or the things that we're talking about that are predominantly going on in one's brain. And I think the pathophysiologies actually are being better understood almost with each passing month. We've been learning so much about really neurosciences, to use that term, the sciences of the brain and the nervous system. And we've learned that there are, for example, pleasure circuits. And we've learned that there are pain circuits. And we know that there are circuits that respond to fears. If someone has had really severe traumas, such as sometimes our returning veterans from our conflicts, military conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, have experienced, those implant themselves in the framework of memory banks and other kinds of things, and those actually influence the functioning of circuits. Now, if you factor in that one has some genetic vulnerabilities, when an event happens in life, sometimes if it's tragic, we end up experiencing clinical depressions. And the symptoms that we just talked about a little while ago start appearing. There is a difference between even the initial symptoms of that type than what I kind of hopefully conveyed as just an example. If your football team loses or you have a bad day on the golf course, it is a very different kind of disappointment, sadness, frustration than what we're talking about with the illness. Those things pass, the first ones, the ones on the golf course. The others tend not to. They tend to actually persist, hang on. Maybe there'll be good breaks every now and then. But if anything, unchecked, they get worse and worse. And eventually they become disabling, and people often require hospitalization, and that's when those suicide thoughts develop. And that's the pattern that we're really trying to focus on in this conversation today. That's what we need to stop.
Okay. Life
Did
is...
I make, clear,
yeah,
by the way?
Yeah, I think okay. So, yes. Life is often said to be more complex now. It's definitely different than it was 50 years ago, 25 years ago, 100 years ago. So the question then is raised is, are we seeing more depression, more severe depression, more anxiety, more bipolar illness than we used to? Or as we become better educated, better knowledgeable, we transmit that information to professionals better, are we just better at recognizing what's always been there?
I think that the second example that you gave is definitely underway. 40 years ago, largely because we didn't grasp the symptoms and how it appeared, we didn't recognize that sometimes even in very young children, clinical depression could begin developing. So it wasn't a diagnosis that was ever used with regard to children. So automatically, when something does start to occur and some of the diagnoses are made, now all of a sudden you say, oh, gee, the rates of diagnosis is increasing. I think it's been a better recognition. It's been an awareness of how these symptoms appear, the ages at which they develop, and it's also been that this is no longer just a syndrome that occurs, for example, and is found in psychiatrists or psychologists or social workers' offices. In fact, most clinical depressions are treated in pediatricians' offices, obstetricians, family medicine doctors, in those primary care settings. So the diagnostic rates have gone up, and I think it's predominantly not because of a change in the stresses or other factors as much as it is that we're finding what was probably always there.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say what popped through my head, Dr. Woodard, is the fact that what's not known generally by the public is that this 1 in 5 figure that you referenced is accurate. That's a lifetime figure. So during our lifetime, we end up having, everybody knows people who have had some clinical depression, lesser or greater severity, but they know people because it's that common. What isn't known is the fact that the symptoms tend to get started during younger years of our entire lifetime. So 15 to 24 is the peak age when people are having some onset of symptoms. Now, not everybody has that pattern, and there are some that occur later. So someone may get to age 45 and experience a death in the family and for the first time have depression. But the majority, a high majority, actually have troubles before then. And so one of the things that I think is really important for us to grasp is we should be finding these things earlier. Why? Because they're most treatable earlier, easier to treat, they're less severe. Second, the changes that occur from multiple episodes of depression really don't do such good things to our bodies, to our cardiac functions, to our brains. And with every episode that we have, it takes a toll. So the more that one has those things unrecognized, the worse off the pattern gets. And those are the ones that end up in the hospital sometimes. So what we really ought to do, if we care about this as a public health pattern and for our own families, is to say, how do we find these things earlier?
And the fact that it's common does not mean that it is necessarily related to how we live our lives or our environment, or that we are weaker psychologically or anything. It implies that the potential risk is always been there, and that these potential problems have always been there. Is that a good corollary to your comments?
Yeah, it's a very good corollary, and it's accurately stated. I think that there is no doubt that stresses, bad stresses, so what do we mean by those? A death of a mother or a parent in general when you're younger, some sort of trauma, car accidents, severe medical illnesses, development of cancer if you're at an older age. Being abused. Now, I suppose, in the modern day and age, we could toss out something like bullying. But bad stresses actually do impact the vulnerability circuits, if you will, of our makeup. And so much is being learned about the genetic vulnerabilities that there are now attempts to say we can develop these into biomarkers or laboratory tests where we may be able to find markers, if you will, that tip off what's going on at an earlier stage. And so stresses in general, it does not have to be one kind or another, aren't very good for us if they're occurring and we are carrying around those vulnerabilities. I think what we want to do right now is to also recognize that there's another part of our genetic makeup that if we can figure out how to tap into it with our treatments, we'll be far more successful, and that's being referred to as resiliency genes, the ones that if you throw a stress at me, I can respond and cope with it and to it, and in the process actually become a bit stronger and emerge from it. We don't know what those are to the same degree yet as we understand vulnerability genes, but we're working at it.
Who gets these? You've already alluded to the fact that the depression certainly starts earlier than we think, and I'm becoming more aware that bipolar illness starts earlier, particularly from studies that have looked at people who have a bipolar diagnosis and can look back and see that these symptoms started much, much younger and much earlier than the diagnosis was made. So what do we know about who gets them and when they get these problems?
Okay, so let's walk through birth and just go through kind of a lifetime. These conditions are really pretty rare, quite rare, and during early childhood. And if you started to say, do you see some in 7, 8, 9 year old boys and girls? Yes, but really pretty uncommonly. All of a sudden, I mean, it trickles up the rates. And then all of a sudden, at about age 12, 13, 14, you start seeing a spike. That's puberty, and no one still fully understands what's going on. But the spike definitely appears, and it appears in all countries, in all races, and in all socioeconomic levels. So there's something distinctly happening that is a reflection of an underlying disorder in those who have these things. Now, something else happens, which is at that point in time, boys and girls begin to separate a little bit. Don't know why, but this also is a pattern that exists in every country where it's been looked at accurately. Girls start to have a greater risk. And so during the teenage years, instead of having two lines that are parallel, suddenly the line for girls shows a greater likelihood. And in total populations, in our lifetime, there's about a 1.7 times greater risk for girls than for boys, or for women than for men. Now, if you looked at the total population for depressions, it ends up being 16%, something like that. And for the bipolar illnesses, you have another 2, 3, 4%, and that's where we get to that 1 in 5 figure that people talk about that you mentioned. And so the subsequent pattern turns out to be that once it's there, and this is another key feature for why it produces so many difficult things, once they have developed, these are so puzzling and we don't get it, but it happens. They come and go. I mean, stresses come, they set it off. In the earlier stages, people can sometimes fade out of these things, but they tend to come back if they're not understood and if another flurry of stresses comes along. And the next thing you know, you're back in an episode. Somebody has a bad experience in adolescence and the first episode develops. But they're not diagnosed often, and then they go off to college and leave home, and then they have another one, and then they have a broken relationship with a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and then another one, and then a bad job evaluation. And pretty soon, they start getting more and more severe. And then at some stage, some doctor somewhere or some friend somewhere will pick this up. And then for the first time, it gets recognized, often by primary care doctors. And that's when treatments start. But then it's 28, 30, 33 years old. And that's rather late. And so a goal, I think, of something that we might talk about, namely the National Network of Depression Centers, Centers of Excellence, is how can we start finding these things earlier when they're more treatable?
This may
By the way, everybody has got some vulnerability. It does occur more commonly, though, in those people who have those family histories. You said this a little earlier. And it's very much like diabetes. So I had a mom. She's dead now, but she had diabetes. Her brother had diabetes and her sister. So I've watched this because diabetes has, as you know from your background, some genetic risk. So I watch it carefully. It's a, it's basically a similar pattern. It ends up being that 15, 16, 17%. But if I have a family member, that risk goes up to like 33%. That's comparable for depression and for bipolar illnesses, whereas it's actually quite rare in the total population, 3, 4%. If I have a family member who has bipolar illness or manic depression, the risk actually can be 50, 60, 70% in some cases. So there clearly are things going on. What we want to do is catch them and keep them in check. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. You know, another thought comes to me while we were talking briefly in specifically about symptoms and manifestations that maybe the public is not as aware of as particularly primary care physicians as opposed to specialists, and that's that multiple somatic complaints are often thought of as related to depression and anxiety in particular, at least in my mind. So I'm asking to correct me if I'm wrong, but the patient who has multiple complaints that are we can't find a real good source of the reason for it. And I'm talking about headaches, abdominal pain, things that are usually pain or often pain related, aches and so forth. So is that often a manifestation of depression, and why would that be if it's true?
It is definitely often a manifestation of depression or correlated at least with it. And rather than making it exclusively one thing causes the other, my word correlated is they just often are found together.
Right.
So they coexist. And for individuals who come in especially with an array of difficult, and these pains are real, but difficult types of pains and persistence, bad headaches and other kinds of things, the linkages are not causes, we don't know yet, but the linkages are pretty well established, and there are connections. And it's why, even in some of the available treatments, the medications that can be given to deal with certain pains are similarly effective for certain types of depressions. How do we explain that? Because pain is perceived in the brain. Stresses exist there. The circuits start affecting each other. Sleep gets altered. The entire cascade kind of gets rolling. And pains are definitely and distinctly more significantly felt among those who have clinical depression. So we don't know, does the one come first? Is it just that the circuits are altered and then they have a greater likelihood of developing together, or are we kind of depressed because we got a lot of pain? And the answer is maybe all of those kind of play a little bit of a role.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. What about myths, since we're trying to make sure everybody understands what we're dealing with? Let's talk about some common misconceptions about these disorders.
Oh, okay. I love it. Well, probably the one that frustrates me most is the fact that, it still is persisting a little bit, that suck it up, stop feeling sorry for yourself, get over this. The issue that this is just, it's kind of a of a pattern of you just don't have enough gumption to take on the things. And that would be a little bit like telling somebody who is having chest pain from cardiac disease, oh, get over it. And that is because we haven't had good ways until recently of even visualizing these things, what's happening in the brain. That's changing now with neuroimaging. But that's one myth. A second one is that it just comes, oh, you're older, get used to it. You know, depression and moodiness and other kinds of things come with growing older. A third one is the fact that there is actual danger in taking some prescription types of things, and there's no danger in taking the stuff that you can buy over the counter, herbal medications or something along those lines. And I'm just kind of free associating now. Let's see. Another one is the fact that we have a little bit of a pattern of we believe, and this is understandable, but we believe that these things, that depression can just, once we're out of it, we're cured. And yet, earlier I just mentioned to you, we tend to have, if you drew a course over one's lifetime, you got little dips and valleys. And that episodic recurrent course is the characteristic one. And so what our thinking ought to be is, how do we stop the next valley from occurring, rather than the fact of, oh, now I'm cured, I'm out of it this time around. And so let's see, I could go on, but maybe if you ask me something, I'll pick up on some other myths. There are an awful lot of them about these things because they haven't been fully understood, which is why I'm so glad you're doing a program on this.
All right. I'm going to take just a second to remind listeners, we're talking about depression with Dr. John Greeden. If you've got questions or comments, let me give you a couple of ways to get a hold of us, and then in a couple of minutes, we're going to take a break. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. Perhaps if you've struggled with depression or have had some experiences, you might want to share those. Toll free, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address again is line1@alaskapublic.org. Another thing that I think I try to get out in programs like this is, what's the natural history of untreated depression? We often are struggling with, what's the risk of treatment, what's the risk of not treatment? So we need to understand what happens in untreated depression to help answer how significantly we should be trying to treat things. What do we know about that?
Okay, so we know a lot. That part is very well understood. And I'm an innate optimist, so I also have trouble answering this part of the question, because we're not doing such a great job in handling what is that kind of course and outcome over time. One, we don't pick it up early enough. Two, we don't treat it early enough. Three, we don't treat it the right way sometimes. And four, once people get better, we don't work hard to keep them better. We think, oh, it's past now. I already mentioned that. And so the overall course, if you will, over time in the outcomes doesn't tend to be very good. Most people with clinical depression that you find in a research study aren't even diagnosed. 50% don't know it. Of those who are diagnosed, half of those aren't necessarily getting treated. So we have an awful lot of work to do. And I think that, more than anything, Dr. Woodard, is probably the reason for some of these distressing figures. So clinical depressions and bipolar illnesses actually are, you said it, I mean, they're the second most costly illnesses, health patterns, in all of American healthcare. And intriguingly, they follow only heart disease, and they kind of wreck that bad statistic up simply because most of them aren't found. Now, if one were going to give a little cliche and they ask me, well, so what can you say, what three things about these things, I'd say these are illnesses, they're treatable, go see a clinician. And yet that's not still happening. So that pattern is something that for people like me, there's a dedication to want to change it. It's why we set out to establish kind of a a center of excellence at Michigan, and then from there, a national network of depression centers to say, let's start looking at this like we looked at cancers. Let's get people to cooperate and collaborate. Let's get hundreds of doctors addressing the problems, and let's push the research agenda so that we can get new knowledge. And then in the process, hopefully, we can reverse the question that you just asked me and the discouraging answer that I think we still sometimes must have to give.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're about halfway through. I'm going to take a short break. I'm going to ask one caller who's called in to hang on. We'll get back to her shortly. Let me remind listeners once again, this is Line 1, your health connection. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back and speak some more with Dr. John Greeden. This is Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest is Dr. John Greeden. He's the founding chair and president of a national network of depression centers and also the executive director of the University of Michigan Depression Center, as well as a former chairman of the Department of Psychiatry. You can reach us directly by email if you have questions in the next 20 to 30 minutes. Line1@alaskapublic.org is our email address. Our direct number, 550-8433. Those of you who are out of state or outside of our listening, our immediate listening area, is 1-888-353-5752. Stephanie, you're on line one. Let's take your call.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I had a son back in 1993 who was diagnosed with ADHD and ODD and later on bipolar. And I saw back then it was pretty hopeless because there wasn't really any meds for children. And I'm wondering today if the pharmaceutical companies have stepped up and started designing meds for children.
Hey, Stephanie, first I'm sorry that you're going through this and even, you know, that your son also struggles with it. But the first message is not to lose hope yet. So if this was the situation in 1993, it's still not perfect yet. But there's been an awful lot of effort thrown in to try to develop treatments that are seen as not only effective but safe for younger children. How old was he when he first had the diagnosis of ADHD? And then how old was he when he, how old?
He was 6 years old.
And then when was the bipolar diagnosis given?
At 12.
Yeah. This is both of those diagnoses exist, but again, we're back into this brain and that very complex and wonderful organ that we all carry around with us, and the circuits that have us pay attention and take in information and think about it and address our moods and, you know, what we do behaviorally overlap. And so when we have attention deficits, they, I think, in an early stage, because that's how they show up in younger children, sometimes, actually, as the course goes on and people get older, and like your son, then all of a sudden it becomes worse, and it's a bit out of control. And then sometimes there are the associated profound sleep disturbances and irritability and rage and impulsivity and the other kinds of things that tend to lead to the diagnosis of bipolar illnesses. Your real question when you started off is, how about treatments? In the past, what we had was lithium. And then we had kind of the traditional age-old antipsychotic medications. There is an entire category of medications right now that by no means are perfect, but are better than what we once had, and they're called atypical antipsychotics, atypical medications. They work, and they help, and they're actually being prescribed for children. The major side effects turn out to be sometimes distressing because without adequate exercise, appetite increases, there's a weight gain pattern. Sometimes you end up having other difficulties, sexual disturbances, this kind of stuff. And kids don't like that as they get older. So they tend to want to resist and don't like taking the medicines. But the industry, I think, has worked at this. There isn't enough energy, and there aren't enough dollars being thrown into all of this yet, in my judgment. So keep encouraging people. If you know anybody in the pharmaceutical industry, keep telling them that we need more, we need better. Am I answering your question?
He did kill himself just about 4 years ago, and he suffered.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
He suffered so hard because what a lot of people may not understand, and they should be exposed to in a healthy manner, is a lot of people with these illnesses are very intelligent. Very intelligent, and he was smart enough to know something was wrong with him. And he finally put a gun to his head.
No, so I'm so sorry.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this, for other listeners and for Stephanie, is the sadness that's associated with this topic. We end up having, if people have severe cancers, they may die from them, and many do. And there's kind of in our societies just an expectation that almost these things occur. When it happens with someone in their younger years, it's a loss. It's seen as this shouldn't occur. And she said two things. One is, just to address it, when people die of suicide and the underlying causes, unfortunately, about 80 to 85% of suicides occur with depression and or bipolar illnesses as the underlying causes. And that's why if there is reference to, I don't want to go on living, it needs to be pursued along the lines of, let's see if we can go after the root causes of this. A second aspect of this is, can these things be treated then? And the answer is yes. But it's not easy, and that's why we still need better research. It's actually, again, Dr. Woodard, why what you and I just mentioned, why I think there's an attempt to say, how can we mobilize and cooperate and bring all kinds of places around the country together to pursue better answers and to work to even develop better treatments.
All right. Yeah, clearly there's more needs to be done. We have one more caller. I want to go ahead and take Chris. You're on line one.
I just wanted to ask about something that I've noticed in myself over the past few years. It seems like during the week I'm looking so forward to the weekend, and I can't wait to do my chores and, you know, things that I enjoy doing. And once the weekend comes around, I don't feel like doing anything. I just want to lay around. I'm not really tired, but I just want to lay around. I get grumpy and antsy, and it's almost like I have weekend depression. I didn't know if that's something that's really out there.
So weekend depression. We have enough diagnostic labels running around. I don't know that there is one that fits that category specifically, but I'll give you something else, which is well known. So one of the functions that we all carry around with us is an entire segment of our nervous system, of our brain, that really is referred to as chronobiology or chronophysiology, and it's the biology of time and rhythms. And what happens is that we tend to have cycles. Alarm clocks go off, coffee pots go on. We regulate ourselves by those things. You may turn on the radio and listen to NPR and other kinds of things, and that's a routine. When we get to weekends, they change. And sometimes changing cycles, changing our time patterns, if you will, actually is well associated with changes in mood and energy, and even pleasure and desire to do things. So it would probably be worth at least thinking about, is that underway? The other aspect is just the routine social things that tend to occur. There are occasions where our jobs are also our social settings, and we like the people. That's always a nice circumstance. If that disappears on the weekend, sometimes the, you know, the desire to do things may dwindle with it a little bit. These are obviously too complicated for me to sit back and say, oh, I can tell you the answer over the phone. But I think you want to keep exploring what's going on and see how you can potentially make it better, because weekends are pretty good times.
Okay. No, I agree. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Chris. Let me remind listeners again, if you've got questions or comments, our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433. It's 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Greeden, I do not want to pass up the opportunity to have you talk about treatment in a little bit more extensive way. So let's do that at this point, if you don't mind. I'm sure listeners want to know what's out there, how effective it is. You've mentioned some side effects, but we also hear so much about the ineffectiveness of some of the treatments. At least it seems to me we're hearing more about it. I'd like to put all this in some perspective for listeners.
No, I'm happy to try and do that. The array of treatments first turns out to probably be easily categorized in the way of when you've heard me mention terms like stress and other kinds of sleep issues and alcohol use and other variables. Those things can and are influenced by discussions that we have, marital conflicts, what's going on in our friends, relationships, parents. And so there's an element of what has been converted into an approach to try to help people understand and cope. And those are the psychotherapies. There are two and even three now pretty well-established research documented effective psychotherapies. And one of them is called cognitive behavioral therapy. And the second one is dialectical behavioral therapy, which is a variant. And then a different theme, if you will, is for those who work on what a therapy called interpersonal therapy. And the bottom line on these is that they're helpful. They tend to be, I think, something that at least in the milder stages, almost everybody should try to utilize. What's going on with me, and how can I get some help, and who can I talk with? And whatever the reasons are, just getting things shared and getting advice often helps. Then there are medications. And the medications now tend to be in about four or five categories. And most everybody has heard of the one group. It's the technical jargon is the SSRI, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And these are the Prozacs and the Paxils and the Zolofts and a variety of others. But they are so well known that we see them on television and we see bouncing balls and commercials, and they work. They don't work for everybody, again, to repeat what I said at the beginning, because we probably have different categories of depressions. They work by blocking the reuptake of a chemical messenger in the brain, and then that means it hangs around more and does its work more effectively, and that's the concept. But not all depressions are serotonin depressions. And then you have a third category of the older types of antidepressants, which were called tricyclics, tricyclic antidepressants, and that was Elavil and Imipramine and some of those. They still work, but they had all kinds of side effects, which is why they're less well used, right, or less frequently used right now. And then another category of the newer medicines, bupropion or Wellbutrin, as sometimes call it, as some people call it, mirtazapine, Remeron, these are trade names. Those medicines have a whole bunch of different actions, and they're trying to go at it by saying, can we affect an array of those chemical messengers in the brain and see whether we can bring about improvement? The next group turns out to be mood stabilizers. And the old one on that one was lithium, and this is back to the very tough question that Stephanie asked. and the sad anecdote about her son. She's saying, are there better treatments that are available? At one time, all that we sort of had was lithium. Now there are alternatives and or different ones, and sometimes those can be used together. So aripiprazole and or basically these are all generic names and they're too much information, but quetiapine or Seroquel, these are meds that now are available for not only depression, but they also help anxiety and they help those bipolar cycles. Newer ones that are also being developed right now are quite exciting. There's just a whole, in fact, NPR ran a series on some of these recently where an anesthetic medication, it's been discovered now that if, in a research way, that if you give it to people who have treatment-resistant depression, meaning they haven't responded to any of these other ones, and you give them ketamine, which is the anesthetic medication, it's almost magical. Sometimes within, at least it appears to us who have always looked for faster action, suddenly within an hour, sometimes they're just feeling better. And whatever is happening, if we can figure out how to sustain it, we've got ourselves a real breakthrough. And then a final category of stuff turns out to be of the treatments, the so-called active treatments, are those somatic treatments, the biological ones in a really different way in the sense that you can do neurostimulation, for example. You can give magnetic stimulation outside the skull. And people, it's like sitting in a dentist chair, and it's referred to as transcranial magnetic stimulation. And I'd be pretty confident that that exists, for example, for your local listeners, even in Anchorage. And then there is a new research treatment that's being developed that actually stemmed from understanding some Parkinson's, and it's deep brain stimulation. A wire is inserted. It's got an external kind of pacemaker, and it also can be very dramatic for the most difficult to treat. And then a traditional one, which obviously we shouldn't forget, is electroconvulsive treatment. No one really ever liked it because of the side effects, but it's dramatically effective. It works. And that array kind of covers the so-called treatments in the way that they're considered. I want to just make a point, which is we should not argue about is one versus another, because for those with moderate or severe depressions, the combination has almost always worked best between medications and psychotherapy, and putting them together seems to do good things. Did I take too much time on that?
No. That's very good. We got a couple of callers, it looks like. What's the bottom line here? Of people who have depression that are appropriately diagnosed and appropriately treated, what's the likelihood of helping them significantly? We won't get into the relapse if you stop the medication, but what's the likelihood with appropriate treatment that we can help them significantly?
It's actually pretty decent, and it's comparable to the outcome rates for just lots of other categories of medications, such as where are we with diabetes medications and things like that. So 70% in stages of, it's not snapping your fingers and having it happen instantly, but 70% improve. And even in the case of just what we always strive for, achieving remission, it's less, but you can get past this. To keep it there, what you alluded to, takes some work, and sometimes it takes the continuation of treatments. But 70% can occur pretty quickly, and you know, in a period of time. I mean, it's not fast, by the way. It's weeks and months, and that's something that's important for people to pay attention to. Excuse me. That outcome is, I think, why almost in a way of just saying this to anybody who has it, any patient that I see, one needs to retain optimism, because it doesn't mean that that's going to be 70% just with the first treatment. And if that one fails, then there are alternatives. The best advice would be at that stage to switch to some with different mechanisms. You know, if something fails, rather than going back to a close relative and different kind of drug of the same category, sometimes it's better to just try alternatives.
Okay.
And the ECT treatments, those ones that have those side effects, are even far more effective. So people should not get totally distressed. It's just that it takes a lot of work.
We're in our last 9 to 10 minutes, so we have another caller. I'd like to go ahead and take Doug's call. Doug, you're on line one.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can.
Okay, good. Thank you for this program. I think it's so important. Here's my question. I'm convinced my stepdaughter's bipolar. I think her mother has finally come to that realization, too. She's 35, and there's been a continuing series of events that have led me to this conclusion. My question is, and she's getting some kind of help from a counselor, but I have no idea whether the counselor's talking to her about the issues that I keep seeing. And so my question is, how am I supposed to respond to it? I recently came to the conclusion that by not saying anything, that I was contributing to her problem. And so I've started talking the truth to her. But I have this lingering concern in the back of my mind is that maybe that's the wrong thing to do. Personally, I just feel like I couldn't go on anymore without saying, you know, I think there's some mental health issues here. You need to think about it. So,
okay.
Well, Doug, this is going to be not a simple answer, but I think you, for the first time on this, I forgot to mention it. You've introduced a word that, unfortunately, is a barrier for those of us who are trying to master these brain behavior illnesses, these mental illnesses, and that word is stigma. Unfortunately, lots of times these are terms and diagnoses that people don't want to hear, and they just dismiss them. I mean, not me, and that's because there's the sense of somehow it's shameful or there are other things going on with it. It's gotten a lot less. At one time, the majority of the population kind of had stigma toward these things. Right now, if you started to look at surveys that are being done, it's just so much better. And in fact, among youth, if you go to college campuses, you find that they just say, oh, no, it's an illness, and you got to go get treated for it. But in this particular case, it might be that the resistance that you're getting about, you know, even if you do bring it up and it's resisted, that's not what's going on with me, and that kind of stuff is to be expected. And so now your question, am I doing the wrong thing by not saying anything? I don't think you want to say it's your fault, but at the same time, you have the opportunity to be helpful and to really turn some things around by bringing it up. And the way to do it is to do it just as straightforward as you can, to say, these are troublesome times sometimes. It's just when you're not feeling well, it affects everybody. It would be nice if there were some things that were going on that could be treated. That would be beneficial for you, for all of us, and we love you, and therefore think about it. And if I can help, I will. I'll go with you, you know, if it means going to see something. Friends sometimes get by with this. Coaches, rabbis, ministers, priests, etc. sometimes are good things. It's often hardest when it's the family member. And unfortunately, you're in a little of that circumstance. But a punchline would be to say, no, you're actually trying to do what I think is good. And don't automatically assume it's going to work out right away, though.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, Doug, thanks
for
your call.
Good luck on it.
Dr. Greeden, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and we had an email that asked the question, where does post-traumatic stress fit into this issue? Particularly, the question is, can children who've had a troubled childhood, perhaps a lot of child abuse or lots of other situations that may have led them to have post-traumatic stress, is this a form of depression? Is depression related to this in some way?
They're definitely related with each other. Depression and PTSD often hold hands with each other. The circuits in the brain have some that are involved with both. A fear response. I mean, something reminds one of an event that happened in the past, or a sound, or a smell, or whatever. And suddenly there's a startle response and cardiovascular heart symptoms develop and visual symptoms change. And that's the pattern of the PTSD. Characteristically, those who struggle with PTSD also have a greater likelihood of struggling with depression. And I think it means that it's another key point that I guess I'm almost glad we're ending here, that we should have a principle in among clinicians as well as among those who go and seek the help. We get a little too caught up with our diagnostic labels, and what we really ought to be doing is treating people. And I think whatever is troublesome, we ought to go after. So if depression occurs with PTSD, they both can and should be addressed. If depression occurs with diabetes, they both can and should be addressed. And in this circumstance, the situations that led to the PTSD, if the depression is part of the story, things work actually best in terms of outcomes if they're both treated. Did that make sense,
yep,
Dr. Woodard?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's and in your clinical hat, that's the same thing, I think, when you're in a pattern with children. And if there are things that are going on and illnesses, it's even true. Another disorder that's gotten a lot of attention is autism. Mm-hmm. And children with autistic spectrum disorder often also have depression.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a lot more we could be discussing, but we're coming at the end of the program, and I really want to take a second to talk to Dr. Greeden our appreciation for taking the time with us today. Keep up the good work, and perhaps we can bug you sometime later to continue this conversation.
No, I'd be interested. I think we can't do enough public education, and I applaud your audience for seeking to learn.
Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Dr. Woodard.
Have a good evening. Dr. Greeden is the founding chair and president of the National Network of Depression Centers and also a former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan. If you'd like to continue this conversation that we're having today about depression, you can on KSKA at Facebook or on Facebook, and you can find the links on our website at alaskapublic.org. And while I'm doing this, I would also mention if you go to alaskapublic.org and look for the link to Line 1, you can find a number of resources that are very reliable about our topic today. Next week, we're going to be discussing some very pertinent information. That's going to be about why we all start, not all of us, many of us start itching, sneezing, and wheezing each spring in Alaska and what we can do about it. We'll learn what's causing this and what are the options for treatment. Our guest will be Dr. Jeff DeMaine. He's a local board-certified allergist and a wonderful discussant. He'll make sure that you understand what's going on with spring allergies. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, May 14th from 2 to 3 p.m. And we remember the program repeats every Monday at 7 p.m. as well. Also, I want to take just a brief second to recognize nurses. This is National Nurse Week. Thanks for all that you do for all of us, and we appreciate it, those of us at KSKA and Line 1. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. I want to say thanks for listening, especially to those of you who took the time to call or email today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.